Welcome to the It's All Happening Women in CPG podcast. I'm your host, Danielle Calabrese, former CPG founder turned executive who finally woke up one day, 16 years into my career, and decided to take back my power and build a community for women in CPG. Tune in as we break down strategies that successful female entrepreneurs are using to build their businesses and talk about what it's like to be a woman in a male-dominated industry. You'll hear stories of the people who make shit happen, overcoming struggles, and celebrating the wins. Whether you're looking for inspiration, industry secrets, or life-changing insights, this is the place. All right, you guys, I just got off with the co-founders of Good Girl Snacks, Leia and Yasmin, and they are just so fun. I love this brand so much. Hot Girl Pickles is their first product. If you are not currently following them on social media, you absolutely should because they are just so fun and entertaining and quite frankly have a badass pickle brand. Their pickles really are just so damn good. So today in this conversation, we're breaking down what it was like for them when they first started out, all of their ops hiccups, how they're rolling out new flavors. They just recently launched Erewhon. They're in Bristol Farms now, and they've got tons of other retailers that they're rolling out. And they give us a full breakdown of what it's been like for them as newcomers in the industry, going up against a male-dominated crowd. And they also break down how they funded this company, what their most recent fundraise was like, and how it was surprisingly super fast and super easy. They really had an incredible time. So I think it goes to show you that they're building something that people really want to be a part of. And I think that's why this brand and this conversation is just so special. And of course, these two women are just so special. So tune in. This is a really good one. I hope you guys enjoy it. Leia and Yasmin, welcome to the It's All Happening Women in CPG podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Yes. So happy to have you guys here and learn about the Good Girl Snacks, Hot Girl Pickle journey. I just love watching you guys on socials. You're very entertaining. So thanks for joining me. First question, I ask all my founders, what are you currently hustling for?
We have a new flavor that we're launching very soon. It'll actually probably be out by the time this episode is out, but figuring out the go-to-market strategy and all the logistics to launch that product and get it to market has been a hustle for sure. And that's like the most recent thing we've been working on. Long term, the mission is really to become a household pickle product and snack product as well.
I love it. So tell us about yourselves and your backgrounds. How did you guys get here? Where did you come from? How did you decide you're going to start this business?
Leia and I both have Middle Eastern backgrounds, and we were both born in Geneva, Switzerland. I was born and raised there up until I left for college. And then Leia left when she was a younger kid. And we both got admitted to the same school. We had never met up until we were like 18 or 19. And when we both got admitted to the same school, we had friends in common connect us and basically, you know, tell us like, hey, like you two are both born in the same city and are both going to the same school. You should meet. So we met. Went to USC together. We were instantly became like best friends. We were attached at the hip for all 4 years. And then we graduated a year into our like real working experiences. We kind of realized that we felt like something was missing in our day-to-day life. And I think we were both yearning for some excitement and for something new. And that's sort of how the idea was born. But we, you know, we're coming from really different backgrounds to what is usually, I don't know, traditional to the food industry. So I was an art history major and I had a minor in marketing and finance. And so I was on a path to work in the art space, you know, whether it be like a gallery or museum or auction house. And then Leia was a communications major with a minor in design. And, you know, she was working in tech doing marketing after college. So we both were in, you know, very different industries, being tech and art.
Okay, so you graduated college, and then how long were you in your first jobs for?
So I was working at the startup. I was out for a year and a half. I had already started in college, so I was pretty burnt out being in like a startup world. And then Yas was working at a perfume startup for a couple months, and then at Christie's for a couple months. So it was about a year-ish after graduation. And we were huge foodies, so food was always something that bonded the two of us, whether it was cooking together, trying new recipes together, sending each other food-related videos. So when we were on the job and really losing our minds, we started scrolling on TikTok all the time. And obviously, the algorithm knew that we were huge foodies, so we were being fed food-related videos all the time. So we started noticing a trend with pickles, kind of similar to how in 2014, avocado toast suddenly became a thing out of nowhere and everyone was eating it. Same thing was happening with pickles. There was 9.5 billion views on the hashtag pickle and pickles combined on TikTok. And just so much social proof that people were eating the snack. We were also going home after work and smashing a jar of pickles as well. So we were kind of connoisseurs of the pickle industry already. But we started joking around, kind of like how every best friend duo does, about, you know, what it would be like to start a company together and riffing ideas off of each other. And Hot Girl Pickles was just an idea that came about. But we started talking to people in the industry because we really saw a gap in the market. The aisle was super sleepy, no flavor innovation, no packaging innovation. No one was really organic, but you then saw so much attention and focus on the snack on socials. So people in the industry really pushed us to do it. We ended up quitting our jobs summer 2023, building in public October 2023. So vlogging the journey of what it's like to start a company with your best friend when you don't know what you're doing, and also quitting a stable job, start a pickle company. That within itself really grabbed people's attention on socials. Yeah. So we ended up going viral before we even launched February, March 2024. So just a little bit over a year ago. Launched D2C, got proof of concept, reformulated, and now we're on a retail journey. So we launched in Erewhon and Bristol Farms, and we have a ton of really large retailer launches coming up in the next couple months, which we're really excited about, as well as two new flavors. Yes. We currently have two flavors, original dill with turmeric, and then one honey harissa flavor, which are inspired by our Middle Eastern background.
Yes, yes. I love that you guys started simple with two flavors, but can't wait to try the new one. Very excited for that. So, okay, I want to talk about the retailer rollout, of course, but let's just rewind a little bit and go back to like those first days, those first months when you guys launched. What types of things were you dealing with? I don't think I've seen like your super early social stuff, but like what types of challenges were you guys up against when you first launched? How did you go to market? I think you had some retailers, like you had a couple of retailers in New York and LA, right? So just talk to me about like really early days.
Really early days, I kind of feel like everything went great and it was almost like too good to be true. And then as time went on and as we started shipping to smaller stores and getting sort of those wholesale orders, is kind of when we started experiencing cases breaking in transit and, you know, a store.
I was going to ask you about
that. That was something that we were expecting with D2C, and we actually kind of decided to spend money on having really great shipping packaging, and it was custom made with inserts to make sure the jars don't break, because we were like, this is our first shot at making a good first impression for someone who's buying, you know, something online and paying expensive shipping and paying for a jar that has a bit of a premium, because we were only making, you know, a small quantity. And so we made that investment pretty early on to make sure that our D2C experience was great, but we hadn't really thought about B2B and what shipping cases would look like. And so, you know, we were like wrapping them in bubble wrap and then putting them in like a regular shipping box. And then those were breaking. And then, you know, we were reusing the cases that our glass jars came in, and kind of like using those as our secondary packaging. And obviously, like once they're filled, the inserts in between the jars don't work. So we were just experimenting with so many different ways of packaging. Ops nightmare. And then obviously, you know, the more bubble wrap you use, the more expensive it gets. And so it was just like really stressful, and having stores reach out to you, be like, where's my case? Like, it broke, or where is it? I never got it. Or, you know, or it breaks and then there's like pickle juice leaking everywhere. And then they're like mad at you because it ruined all their other cases. So it was very fun to deal with.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's something that we're not really experiencing anymore. Now that we're shipping in larger volumes, we're able to just bypass this.
Yeah. So you solved that issue.
Yes.
I imagine you're probably working with some distributors now too, right? Mm-hmm. That probably like is a huge operational weight off your shoulders, I would imagine.
We also had really bad luck with cucumbers, and we called it Cucumber Gate. There was a few things that happened to us that were just so annoying, and we ended up creating a series about it on socials and making it a marketing moment. But there was...
Love it.
Cucumber Gate. Here's what it is.
Tell us about Cucumber Gate, please.
So we had a truck that picked up our cucumbers, and the company ended up using the wrong type of truck after we've waited months to have a cucumber supply, and they froze thousands and thousands of pounds of our cucumbers. And so that delayed us 2 months in terms of like our first launch ever, which was annoying because we obviously had eyeballs on us and people were ready to purchase the product. We ended up doing a pre-sale to kind of like spin it, and it ended up being like a great marketing thing. But that was one thing that was crazy.
So wait, the truck transported your cucumbers frozen and froze your cucumbers.
Yeah, it was basically
and that obviously ruins them.
Yeah, it was a frozen, like it was a truck, it's like a frozen truck. And so it froze all the cucumbers. And we made that video talking about it, and everyone in the comments was like, well, can't you just like let them thaw? Like surely you can just use them. But once they're frozen, they're ruined, which is also so wasteful. But that video ended up getting us a lot of views. And we always say that everything happens for a reason, because it actually got us more followers. And so by the time we launched, we had actually even more eyeballs on us, which ended up being great.
Yeah. We also had another Cucumber Gate moment where we got super unlucky with weather, and there was a huge storm that washed out all the cucumbers, and we just had like a bunch of things at the beginning that were big learning curves, where now we kind of know the business a lot more and we've been doing this for a while now, so we kind of get it. But at first, obviously, you're just starting. Like, I'm straight out of a tech startup. I have no idea how to grow a cucumber out of the earth or like what can happen. And so we were just getting so frustrated at the beginning. But it's a good lesson for anyone out there. If you're starting a business and you're building it in public, make those bad moments a marketing moment.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I love that advice. But also I feel like too, early stage founders can sometimes like really be hard on themselves about this kind of stuff. But like, guess what, guys? This doesn't stop happening.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to deal with supply chain and ops problems. Like ops, no matter how good you are, like you could hire the most seasoned, experienced ops people that have like done this 20 times, exited companies, have all these like all this amazing software and systems built out. And like shit happens.
Yeah.
Like shit happens. The truck shows up, it's supposed to be refrigerated, and the driver like accidentally took a frozen truck, or weather issues, or I mean, it's just ops is like a constant.
Yeah.
Fire hose. You're just like drinking out of a fire hose, essentially.
Yeah, literally.
I feel like you think that like, oh, well, as we get bigger and like we have funds to hire more experienced people, it's going to get better. But like still this kind of shit happens. Yeah. So
keeps you on your toes.
For sure.
Did you know that 70 to 80% of CPG brands fail within the first year? Yikes. Because they lack a strategic go-to-market plan, they start without enough funding, or they don't have a clear path to sustainable growth. We've got you covered though. So in Launch Lab, you'll learn how to launch, grow, and scale your brand the right way. We'll give you a step-by-step roadmap, insider strategies for success, marketing and sales playbook, funding and financial guidance. So this is for you if you're a first-time food and beverage CPG founder, you have an idea for a brand and you need a playbook, you're in the early stages and you haven't yet nailed your go-to-market strategy, or you want to expand. You're navigating farmers markets or Shopify and want to venture into retail. Maybe you're developing your product and you're delving into formulation or contemplating a retail entrance. You need strategic guidance. You can be operational, but you're still seeking to refine your go-to-market strategy. Launch Lab Masterclass March, April, May session is sold out. But not to worry, we're launching another session in September. We kick off that first week of September. So go to the show notes and sign up to be on the wait list to get notifications about when early registration opens up. Trust me, if you are doing this for the first time, this is an educational session you absolutely do not want to miss.
Okay, so you guys are in Erewhon now. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what month of business did you roll out Erewhon? So it had been like a full year, right?
Yeah, we were coming up on 1 year of being in business.
Okay.
So we launched in Erewhon at the end of January of 2025, and we had launched our brand
March.
End of February, March 2024.
Cool, so about a full year. Now, can you share a little bit about Erewhon? Because so many early stage brands, that's like their gold standard of first retailers. Mm-hmm. What was your process, your selling process like with Erewhon?
Well, I think for us, we just had a really unique value proposition, being that we were one of the only organic brands on the market for pickles. And that's kind of what we told them. We were like, hey, like, look at your fridge. You have no organic pickles. And that's something that they really care about. And more, I think we're really honing in on brands that are organic as opposed to just being non-GMO. And so for them, I think we were just, you know, it was an appealing sell because we have very unique packaging. We were disrupting a space of their store that, you know, hadn't really been innovated in a while. And so I think that on top of having a pretty decent social media following at the time, and
they knew you were going to be able to support it and get the word out.
Exactly. Yep. And, you know, we kind of came in with a very strong marketing strategy and go-to-market strategy for them. And I think they really liked it. So, yeah, I think they really want brands that are hands-on, you know, that care about clean, having a clean ingredient label.
Absolutely.
And, yeah. And I think they probably had a feeling that their customers would appreciate the product. I don't think they anticipated how much they would, because we kept selling out, and I don't think they were like ordering as much as, you know, I don't think they were really like matching the demand initially.
It takes a minute, right?
Totally.
Yeah. It takes a minute at like the store level to understand how much of your product they need to carry to make sure it doesn't constantly, because they don't want to be out of stock.
Exactly.
They don't want to miss out on sales.
Yeah. It was actually crazy because we were showing up to do demos, because obviously, you know, you get into a grocery store and they're like, we recommend you do X amount of demos per month or per store. Yeah. So we were kind of following suit, and we would show up and there was no product for us to do demos with. So we were getting turned away, which, again, great marketing scheme to post about that. But yeah, it was a great partnership, still is. We love the team at Erewhon. And it's interesting to see, you know, now we're also at Bristol Farms and learning like who's buying our product at Erewhon versus Bristol. Like, we're on the shelf at Bristol Farms, whereas Erewhon, we're in the fridge. How is that making us sell differently? And we're just learning so much and collecting so much data.
Let's talk about that, because I didn't realize that you guys could have shelf stable placement. So I just assumed that you had to stay cold chain. So how is it moving in comparison to Erewhon? I mean, I would imagine the velocities are higher at Erewhon.
Yeah,
right?
It's kind of a tough comparison just because each store have like see different velocities for their products.
Yeah.
I think typically Erewhon sees higher velocity than Bristol Farms in general.
Yes.
But I would assume that, you know, being in the fridge also adds to that velocity, just because people are more likely shopping on the perimeters of a store. Or I think there's something like some statistic about there being more foot traffic on the perimeters of the store. And so you're getting more eyeballs on your product. And then, you know, the pickle aisle on the shelf, you know, if you're in the fridge, you know, you're with like the deli section, you're with hummus, you're with a bunch of other products that people would shop for, versus on the shelf, you know, you're with like olives and artichokes and like pickled asparagus and pickled okra and all this like random, all these
vegetables. Condiment adjacent. Totally. Yeah. Like close to condiments, which can be a slow area of the grocery store. Yeah.
We're also on the very bottom because like bottom shelf at Bristol, because of how big our jar is, it doesn't fit higher up.
Oh.
And so we've had to do some really funny marketing around that.
Yeah.
Like you can get a workout in when you go grab your hot girl pickles at Bristol Farms, do some squats, do some stretching.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that also has something to do with it. But we're very happy with both accounts, and it's really interesting for us to get data from both. Obviously, Erewhon also provides us with numbers and how much we're selling per week, whereas we
Which is why they're amazing.
We don't get that from Bristol, obviously, so we just kind of assume. But yeah, we're excited to keep expanding into bigger chains as well and continue to learn about our consumer and demographic.
Okay, so what are some like surprising things that you guys have learned about distribution since you started? Like, so you signed up with, I'm sure Erewhon recommended a distributor for you guys, right? And is that the same distributor you're working with Bristol, or did you set up another distributor with Bristol?
No, we have two, we're with two distributors, and then we're about to be with a third one later this summer. But yeah, I think everyone always talks poorly on distributors and, you know, how they'll get you for every fee and, you know, just wait until you see your invoice at the end of the month and it's like all the deductions. And so that's something that we kind of heard going in, and I think we were prepared for it. But had we not been, I think that would have been a massive surprise to see like all these things being deducted at the end of the, at the end of the month from your invoice.
Yep.
But I think overall, it's been really great for us working with the distributor, and it's alleviated a lot of hurdles, especially being that we're in a glass jar, like we were talking about early on.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, no complaints. We'll take the few losses. I think it's worth it.
Talk to us a little bit about your strategy and how you guys are rolling out retailers. Do you have regions that you're focused on, or are you, I think I've heard you guys say before, we want to be in every retailer in the country.
Yeah.
Which is great, but are you doing, like, are you focused on regionality right now, or is it sort of just like, you're talking to everybody?
Yeah, we're really focusing on regionality and looking at where our demographic and where our followers exist and where we're getting the most demand, which is, you know, the best thing about social media is that you'll get comments like, you know, come to Texas or come to Michigan. Yep. And, you know, you had no idea that you had a following there. And so we're looking at that. And then we're also looking at, you know, realistically, you know, our product's organic, our product is, you know, very cute looking, it's very unique. You know, where are the shoppers that would care about something like this versus the shoppers that just, you know, would buy like a Vlasic pickle or like a Clausen and just a generic Mount Olive brand? So I think because of that, it kind of landed us, the two of those things together landed us on really focusing on the West Coast and the East Coast as well. Honing in mostly on the West Coast just because that's where we are and we're able to, you know,
home
be
trip,
there, yeah,
support
it in person, especially with our marketing efforts. So yeah, we, you know, are focusing on natural channels first and really honing in on the stores where we know those early adopter shoppers will be going to, such as Erewhon. You know, we're also at Good Earth in Utah, which has kind of a similar demographic of shoppers. And then looking at other stores in the U.S. that kind of have that similar similar brand of retailers that really care about organic products and that have shoppers who are willing to try a new product that's fun and flavorful and looks cute on the shelf.
To keep it simple, it's really staying focused with what stores we're launching in, but then promoting high velocity in each store. So it's like slow and steady wins the race, but we're turning product quickly in each account, if that makes sense.
Yeah, of course. I mean, velocity is, that's what everybody's focused on at retail. So what are some of the things you guys are doing to make sure that like you're turning quickly, separate from, obviously you have a super strong social following and that helps tremendously, right? But what else are you guys doing at like the retail level to help like move the needle?
So it's mostly on social media focused, but we also, every other aspect of our organic marketing strategies always tie back to the grocery store. So whether that's like an activation. So for example, we had a cool down with Hot Girl Pickles station at Revolve Fest at Coachella. We had a sign there that had like, oh, we're available at Erewhon and Bristol Farms. Our website, even though you can shop the product on the website, it's promoting where we're in store.
You're pushing to retailers.
And then now, you know, we're slowly starting to sophisticate our marketing strategy to help support the growth into retail. So, you know, looking into Instacart ads and maybe billboards, maybe like more guerrilla marketing things that are out and about near the locations of where the stores will be or are. So those are just some things we're doing.
I love out of home marketing strategy to support retail. I think it's sometimes people like overlook it and they're looking for something that's like more in store. Mm-hmm. But out of home, like wheat pasting and billboards and stuff, I love for retail rollouts.
It's so
fun. I've done that with a couple of companies.
And then we also were like building an army as well of people that we're going to use to run demos for us and make sure we're pushing product like actually on the store floor, as well as, you know, running TPRs and promos in store. And we know that there's a playbook for that. So we're really following what the store recommends. And so far, so good. Yeah. So hopefully it stays that way. And I think the combination of all the things we're doing just work really well.
Yeah, I think we're kind of in a learnings phase of the business as it comes to in-store marketing and sort of figuring out what works best and just taking on all this data that we're getting and figuring out, you know, how many demos a month is the ideal number of demos, or, you know, is this promotion, this percentage TPR like sufficient? Does that push sales enough? And, you know, if we're just kind of gathering all this data and building out what our strategy will be over the next few months. And so, yeah, we're learning a lot still.
Talk to me about Coachella and how that experience was for you guys and like what you learned from customers and just like, would you do it again?
I talk about this activation once a day. It's actually insane how much ROI we got from doing this. We got in front of every influencer ever and they all tried the product. The amount of content we got from doing that and the amount of views we got on each of those videos was just insane. We also got in front of new investors. Like, so much more happened in that one day than we thought.
We're anticipating.
Also, we got like, or I got an hour of sleep before, and it was, we were running it from like, we were there at like 7:30 or 8 a.m. until 7 p.m. and then we went to Coachella. So it was a very intense day. It was amazing. The product was great. And we really pushed like other marketing aspects as well there. So like we were giving out hats and tote bags and just and stickers, like things that would create continued marketing for us even after the event. So I mean, it kind of made us realize like influencer events and things that are more geared towards people that have a following may actually be worth our time and effort, because we've been really focused on doing things scrappy and our community is our influencer. So they like, obviously that's still the fact, like a fact, and still something we'll prioritize, but I think it's important to start involving more influencer forward activations.
And I think the product also kind of speaks for itself, because it's so random to have a pickle stand at a festival or like at a party. And so people were walking around and they would see our booth and they would like, pickles? Like what? Like even if they weren't pickle lovers, they just would come up to us because they were like, what is this? Like, this is so random. What are you guys selling? And what do you mean you're called Hot Girl Pickles? Like, I love that. The girls loved the name. And so, we really stood out just because no one, you know, was doing anything remotely similar to what we were doing.
An unexpected location with an unexpected product, but it just worked because your whole, like everybody who was there at that festival in that area that you guys were in are people that you want to buy your product at Erewhon and Bristol and all the other places that you guys are going to roll out in. So I think it's great.
Also, pickles are natural electrolytes, and they're obviously very satisfying to have when it's so hot out and they're so cold. So we actually got to do a big education piece as well being there, because people are like, why would you be there? And then we'd be like, oh, it's actually really great for you to eat a pickle when it's 105 degrees outside in the middle of the desert. So that was cool to do as well.
Yeah, totally. The education, I feel like the electrolytes thing, that's like such a cool like value prop that nobody's talking about with pickles. I like that for you guys. Okay, so one thing I wanted to talk about before, but we just kind of like got down like the retail rabbit hole, is your co-packer and like setting up a co-packer. How is that process for you guys? And did you set up co-packer on day one?
Yes.
Yeah.
We were very lucky to be connected to an amazing duo of consultants very early on. They were pretty much the first partners we signed on with, and they, you know, really liked the idea. It was very new to them. I think they were also very new at setting up like their own consulting business, and so we both kind of like were at a similar point of our journeys. And one of them is a food scientist and operations specialist, and then the other one also runs operations, but she really specializes in matching you with a co-packer, finding you suppliers, connecting you with all the right vendors. And so together they developed our recipes, because we had been making them at home and they did not taste they did not taste like how they do now.
You're like, we need some professionals to come in here.
So they, you know, developed our recipes in a way that was scalable, which was super important, which is something we didn't know at the time. And then they also basically connected us to a bunch of different co-packers in the U.S. that had organic certifications, because it was just easier for us to jump on a facility's organic cert rather than be certified ourselves, which is very expensive to do. Initially, we manufactured in Massachusetts at a very small co-man. You know, it was a very small MOQs. They actually mostly work with businesses local to Massachusetts. So it was really random for us to come in from LA and be like, hey, like, we're the pickle girls. But we really loved working with them, and it was a perfect place to start because it was small quantities, although Leia and I very naively wanted to manufacture like 200 jars initially. And then they were like, you just want to be like on the safe side. Like, we don't know if these are going to sell. Like, we don't want to make too much and then not be able to sell them. And then, you know, we were like, okay, it turns out it's going to have to be a couple thousand.
Yeah, a couple thousand jars. 200 jars. Maybe you guys should stick to the kitchen. You know,
Literally. And then, we realized, okay, you can't even get like glass jars without ordering a couple thousand. So we started off there, and that was really great. We had one production run there, and then we kind of just quickly graduated from that facility because we saw that we had a lot of demand and we wanted to move to a place where we could easily scale and sort of set up that process earlier on. And so we switched last year in the summer to a facility.
Was that transition challenging? Was it difficult to transition?
It's always a bit difficult when you have to kind of like educate the co-packer on your product, and you kind of have to, you know, this new facility was operating at such a larger scale versus most of it before was manual labor. And so now you're switching to machinery. And so things just move differently. Quantities taste different. So even though it was the same formula, like the product wasn't tasting the same. And then you have to sort of, you know, realize like, okay, like maybe we need to be switching to this honey instead, because, you know, when it's made in such a larger quantity, it tastes really sweet and you taste it too much.
Right.
So those were sort of the adjustments that we were dealing with. But we ended up, you know, learning a ton, and we had also gathered a ton of consumer feedback from our first round. And so we had implemented that and adjusted our formulas with that in mind.
Did you change? You've changed your recipe a couple times?
Yes, we've changed it. We It was a whole thing. We called them our glowed up pickles. That was like our big thing last summer. Nice. Because we gathered so much feedback from customers. We sent out surveys to everyone. We even just, you know, asking our friends and asking people who told us they tried them what they thought, and gathered all this feedback and adjusted our formula accordingly. So we made them saltier. We made the brine less acidic. We changed the size of the cucumbers. And then we just sort of landed on a formula that we think is pretty close to perfect. And even now we're still tweaking it. You know, like we'll try it and we'll be like, okay, maybe next time more salt, or maybe next time like less of this. Yep. But we're pretty happy with where
they're really good. They are really, really good. Yes.
Thank you.
I love them. I haven't had the honey ones, mm-hmm. but I've had multiple jars of the original, right? Is that what you call it? The flavor?
Yes.
Yeah.
It's original dill with a turmeric twist is the full name.
So
they're
good.
Not like your basic pickle. It's we kind of like to explain it as like a elevated or more sophisticated dill pickle.
Yeah, yeah. They're really good. I mean, I'm totally a pickle girl. Like I grew up eating pickles. I love them so much, but yours really are absolutely delicious. So,
thank you.
Well
thank
done,
you so
ladies.
Much. Well, yes. We're excited for you to try our new flavor too. You're going to love them so much.
I can't wait. Okay. So what is the main focus in the business right now? Like what are you guys just like laser focused on right now?
Distribution.
Distribution.
Yeah. Yeah. Distribution and growth, of course.
Yeah.
But really distribution. Mm-hmm. And then we're also coming out with a new format for our product.
Oh.
So that's something that we're really...
Anything that you can share?
Nothing that we can share just yet. But we're very excited because... we just think it's going to do really well, and hopefully we're not jinxing ourselves by saying this out loud, but we're really excited. We're in the R&D process for it, and we haven't really shown too much of it on social media or anything. We're trying to keep it kind of hush-hush because we want it to be like a big reveal, but it's something that we're really excited about. And so we're also working on, you know, go-to-market strategy for that and what the distribution channels for that will be, if, you know, we're going to have it be the same as they are now, or whether we want to go a different route this time around and kind of like test some new channels.
Oh, I'm so excited for that. I can only like guess and make some assumptions, but sounds super fun. So how did you guys get going? Like, did you start with a friends and family round? Did you take out loans? How did you guys financially get your business off the ground?
So we were bootstrapped up until very recently. It was mostly friends and family. We also basically only spent money on like production and then our branding at the beginning. We still have a $0 CAC, so we've spent nothing on marketing other than like, you know, a couple hundred here and there for things that haven't been gifted to us. We've been very lucky to have built this like massive social media community because we get a lot of things in return for free, which is nice. But yeah, we ended up raising our pre-seed round a couple weeks ago. We closed
a couple months ago now.
A couple months ago, yeah.
Oh, yeah. My God.
Congrats. Help. That's such a thing.
Thank you.
Yeah.
How was that? Like, how was it? Did
it
you
was
have like
crazy.
These? Was it? Did
yes.
you have like all these like preconceived like assumptions of what was?
So we had already established a lot of relationships with a lot of people that were interested, which was really great. Because we were just able to tap them and be like, hey, we're ready now. But we didn't realize how quickly we were going to do it. We got very lucky. We obviously had to redo our deck a couple times. Like, we didn't really know what an investor would want to see. I think we probably have 17 versions of the same deck on Canva somewhere.
Yeah.
And it's just because we didn't realize, like, oh, we have to create a chart with all of the different potential stores we're going to be in, not just this year, but like in the next 2-3 years. And a lot of it is BS. Mm-hmm. And you just have to like learn how to pitch your brand and really believe in it, which we do. And we're so passionate about it and we have proof of concept and we have data. So I think it was a lot easier for us to raise now versus before when we didn't have any grocery data.
Totally.
We didn't have proof of concept in store. We just had it online. We obviously have like a huge cult following as well. The product's really good now. So we were just ready. And we ended up closing the round in 2 weeks, which
amazing.
Is really nuts.
That's really great. Yeah, I feel like investors, they want to see the big picture, right? They want to know what the next like 3 to 5 years looks like. But you guys are still so early stage. And like, sure, you can predict what your strategy is going to be and what your rollout is going to be. But who knows? You may have to pivot or things can happen, right?
Yeah.
So it's... I agree with you. I think it's okay to say like it's BS because anything could happen, right? There
totally.
Could be like a massive shift in the market and like something totally unexpected.
Yeah. And also we always heard people telling us like, oh yeah, once you get your first check from somebody, everyone's going to want to, you know, give you money and it's going to create this whole FOMO thing. And we were like, there's no way that's going to happen. We closed our round, and the second we closed the round, we've never gotten more interest. We're like, where was this a month ago when we started?
Yeah.
You
closed it, and then all of a sudden, all these people came out of the woodwork.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh, like, any chance you would reopen your safe?
Yeah.
Yeah, you file those for the next time.
Exactly.
And you'll see, you know?
Totally. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. We were lucky to have a lot of guidance through the process. We have a pretty like VC heavy friend group, funnily enough. And so a lot of our best friends work in the industry and they did
That's
this
amazing.
All the time, or like they look at decks all the time. And so they were able to look at ours and be like, hey, like maybe don't say this, or like, hey, maybe you guys should talk about this. Like this would be really interesting, or this is the kind of thing people are going to want to know. And so that was really, really helpful.
Having that strategic advice is like so priceless. So do you guys aspire to have Good Girl Snacks acquired one day?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're building this company to sell for acquisition.
Yeah. Yes. We always say we want to be Gen Z Siete. So we want to build a company that has a collection of snacks that reawaken sleepy aisles, that tap into nostalgia in one way or another, but also that always have flavor innovation and packaging innovation.
Yeah.
And through that eventual collection of snacks, we'd like to get acquired. Yes.
Yeah.
That's the plan.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. So what has it been like for the two of you as young women entering into this like pretty niche industry without any experience, being thrown into the world of CPG, sales, distribution, regulations? Like, how have you navigated the male dominance of it all?
Yeah. It's funny because when we started out, especially, we really surrounded ourselves by mostly women. And it was so great to have that support and to sort of surround ourselves with women who are very strong and, you know, had experience in the industry. And it was something that, you know, we were able to look up to, especially as we were navigating hurdles that we had never, you know, dealt with before. Oh. And now, obviously, we're working with more men. You really get like two sides of a coin. Like on one hand, you'll have the men who are really rooting for you and who are like, yes, like I love that you two are two girls doing this, like girl power. They're here for it. They want to help how they can. And then you'll get the men who like will be like mansplaining to you a lot, or, you know, really speak to you as if you were born yesterday and, you know, it's like your first time doing this, which, you know, sometimes it is our first time and we just kind of have to fake it and pretend like we know what they're talking about. So it's interesting because I feel like sometimes I'll be like, wait, like he's right to talk to me this way because I don't really know what I'm doing. But then at the same time, it's like, would he be talking to me this way if I was a man?
No.
And if I was a little older?
No.
And yeah, we know what the answer is to that. So
yeah,
it's tough. And it's made us think like, should we like create a fake male employee and just have him deal?
I love that.
We literally were talking about it like last week. We were like, maybe we should have, I don't know, like a male employee who, you know, is just one of us, but just by email, it's just like some man emailing people.
But we've learned to deal with it in a couple ways. One, being overly confident and loud. Like sometimes Yas and I are in meetings, like sitting right next to each other, and we're talking to a man that maybe is just cutting us off every 2 seconds or like extremely overpowering. And I swear I've started speaking a lot louder and it's helped. And then just being just extremely educated on everything, like knowing the answer to every single question so that we can almost answer it before they even finish their thought has kind of reinforced that we know what we're doing.
Yeah. Knowing your business.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think now too, like that we have this proof of concept and that we are building confidence, not only in ourselves within this new industry, but also with like seeing the success of the business, it's a lot easier for us to speak eloquently and in a way that makes us sound and feel like we know what we're doing, even though we look really young and we are really young and we are just two girls, you know? So
Exactly. But at the same time, like nobody knows your business like you guys do. You're the founders, right?
100%.
You developed it. You've been there since day one. And like maybe you don't have like all the background of experience, but you know your specific business. Mm-hmm. And guess what? It's working, right?
Yeah.
It's working. So that instantly gives you credibility.
Yeah.
And if you know your numbers and you know like all the technical stuff about your business, I think those conversations just become easier and easier.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, totally. Okay, last questions before we wrap it up. So what next couple of years, what is the, like, what's the vision? What's happening in the next couple of years?
I think expanding our line beyond pickles would be the goal. We have a ton of ideas for other snacks we want to go into. And so sort of like Leah mentioned, I think the goal would be to have a collection of snacks that are all better for you, easy to eat on the go, and really keep women's needs in mind, because that's sort of the whole premise of our business, is catering to the things that women like to snack on, the things that they like to eat, and then, you know, using the appropriate marketing to speak to them directly. So that's the mission. And we're excited to develop new products.
I love that. What sage advice would you give to another female founder starting out today?
I always feel like I have a different answer to this question.
Yeah,
it can be a different answer.
I think I always give the advice that you should use all of the tools that are free to you to the most of their capabilities. So you need to be posting every single day on social media. That's just as important as raising money. It's literally free. You're getting your product in front of a million eyeballs. You're getting your story out there, and you're not paying a dime for that. And everyone has a phone at this point. Everyone has social media. You probably know how to use it because you're probably interacting with content 24/7. So don't be afraid to put yourself out there. You should put yourself out there. And it's the best way to succeed. And it's the best way to create a support system around you as well. That's something people don't really talk about. But when we were starting out, we didn't necessarily know who to reach out to or like who to ask questions to. And having a presence on social media allowed people in the industry to really enter our orbit. And now we can lean on, you know, other founders or people that, you know, can support us through a consulting way or sales brokers or all of that. So yeah, post on social media, use the tools available to you.
That's great advice. I work with early stage founders, and I was actually just having a conversation today with somebody about this, because she really is just, she doesn't want to put herself out there. But I think founders can sometimes overlook, which I get, like I get it, you know, especially if you didn't grow up with it, you know, like my generation learned it later on. So it's not it's not so natural. It's not just like an extension of my hand. Like I really have to think about it, you know? My kids, it's going to be totally different for them. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes you underestimate like truly the power of it, of having that founder face out there. And it just goes, it just seems to be going so much faster for the founders that are putting their face out there.
Yeah.
The brand growth, right? Like that traction, it's just so much faster.
Yeah. I mean, you're humanizing a product at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And I think people want to feel personal connections. Like I think humans yearn for like human connection. And so when you have somebody on your screen that's speaking directly to you and speaking directly to a problem you also may be having, that's so much more powerful than, you know, a static ad or like a photo or something like that.
Totally. Totally. Ladies, thank you so much for chatting with me today. This was so fun and I loved hearing about your story. Yeah, we're going to have to do this.
Us.
We're going to have to do this again. Thank you.
Yes, please.
Thank you so much.
If you liked what you heard, it would mean so much if you follow and review us wherever you listen to podcasts. For tips and advice on your food and beverage CPG brand, you can find us on Instagram at It's All Happening Co. or visit our website at itsallhappeningagency.co to be the first to hear about workshops, courses, and in-person events and freebies. Until next week.